I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with Dr. Mario Beauregard. I'm not sure how you say that. Beauregard. He's a neurologist, and we're going to talk about his book, The Spiritual Brain. How are you, Dr. Beauregard?
I'm fine.
Good. Before we get started, you want to take a quick minute and tell us a little bit about you and where you people can find you.
I'm a neuroscientist based at the University of Montreal, and I did a bachelor degree first in psychology, and then a PhD in neuroscience at the University of Montreal, and then I did two postdoctoral fellowships. The first one was at NIMH and also at the University of Texas in Houston.
Okay.
And the second one was in also in neuroscience at University of McGill at the famous Montreal Neurological Institute in Montreal. And so now I'm affiliated with the departments of psychology and also radiology at the University of Montreal. And I'm also a member of the Neuroscience Research Center over there.
Now, where can people find you if they want to look, get your book or read about you?
If they enter my name in Google, they can have access to a lot of information related to what we are doing in our lab. It's the website of the lab.
Okay.
So people have only to enter Dr. Mario Beauregard, and they will end up there.
Beauregard is your last name,
exactly.
Right? Okay. I kind of conduct my interviews kind of like a deposition because I'm in litigation. And I have a bunch of questions for you here, so be patient with me if I don't understand some scientific stuff and just help me understand, because this is my passion, consciousness. First of all, what is your definition of consciousness?
Well, I will give you the definition that is used in neuroscience and then perhaps my own definition. But in neuroscience, consciousness refers mostly to awareness. So it's related to perceptual processes. So there's a visual awareness and also awareness of other senses. And there's also an awareness of what's going on inside, within, with respect to mental processes, and then we speak more of self-awareness or self-consciousness, if you will.
Okay.
But there's also, when one is interested in the mystical tradition, like me, then consciousness can be seen as a property of a higher or a transcendental being at the origin of everything in the universe, and that's also another definition that I consider. But of course, when we do work in neuroscience, it's mostly related to the first definition I gave you, to awareness related to the senses and also awareness of mental processes going on internally.
Well, when I'm talking about consciousness, I'm kind of using your personal definition, the ground of all being,
okay,
or the field or the force, just so we're on the same page about that word.
Okay.
If it's different, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, second of all, what is your definition of mind? And
mind,
is...
well, usually it in both psychology and neuroscience, it refers to the mental processes. So, for instance, perceptions and also emotions, memories, thoughts, sensations, and so on and so forth. So it's the collection of all those mental processes, if you will.
Do you think... there, to get my question here, you know, some people talk about big mind and little mind. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, well, it relates to the personal definition of consciousness that I gave you. Yeah, you can consider that there's a smaller mind, if you will, the kind of mind that we use in everybody's life, but also there's sometimes access to a higher mind and higher consciousness. And then it's related to the transcendental being that I was talking about earlier, or a higher self is another definition.
How do you think and I'm going to say little mind here, distinguishes mm-hmm. itself from big mind? I mean, how do we become individuals from the big mind? From the scientific perspective, have you done EEGs? Is there anything from science that you can mm-hmm. see that helps us understand
well,
how mind
Well, this question has not been studied yet directly, but based on what I've seen in our own studies with Carmelite nuns and also in other studies with Buddhist monks, it seems that the smaller mind and consciousness is related mostly to fast waves. Beta waves, usually.
Okay.
That's the definition of these waves. And these are rapid waves, and they are associated with an awareness of what we're doing usually during the day. So it's quite rapid, and it focused the attention externally. So it's you're not really conscious or aware of what's going on internally, subjectively. And so for instance, of deeper thoughts or spiritual visions and so on and so forth. And it seems that to be able to access these spiritual realms, if you will, you need your brain waves to slow down. So for instance, in the Carmelite nuns, we saw a lot of theta waves, which are slow waves. Their frequency range between 4 and 8 hertz. And we saw also delta waves while they were in a state of a mystical union with God, according to their own terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And delta waves are even slower, so they range between 0.5 and 4 hertz. And usually these waves are seen during deep sleep and also in various coma states. But in the case of the nuns, they were totally awake, and it's due to the practice, the spiritual practice that they had, because they spend thousands of hours in prayer and contemplation. And so I think that the higher mind and higher consciousness, you can access to this if your brain is not as busy as usual. So it has to slow down. And so that I think that's the best piece of information we have so far regarding this question.
That makes me think of another question. I didn't have this question down, but I had an experience like this where just to make a long story short, I'm just basically living a normal life one day,
mm-hmm.
and boom, I blinked my eyes, and from that moment on, I was different. I had a profound spontaneous enlightenment, and I wasn't seeking and I wasn't praying. I didn't know anything about this. I didn't know that it existed. Why? How would something like that happen? Because I don't pray to get in that kind of state. It just happened. How would that happen? Do you know?
Well, it happens. These things happen spontaneously, apparently, for several people. I've received letters from people all over the world telling me about an experience similar to yours. And
it stays here forever. It never went away.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes you can do a few things that will put you in a more receptive state for spiritual experiences. However, it seems that we don't have total control over these experiences. So other people who do not pray or do contemplation, meditation, sometimes they will have experience like yours, and they don't know exactly why. But so it's like a dance, you know. It's the higher self or higher consciousness, higher mind seems to play a key role in this. And so the little mind or little consciousness is not always fully aware of the purpose of this. And so it's like you can help yourself in being receptive, but that's the only thing you can do. And even though you're receptive in a meditative state, for instance, that doesn't mean that you will have a very strong spiritual experience. So it seems that there's also an involvement from a spiritual plane, you know, in the generation of such experience. So it's not totally the responsibility of the human mind or the little mind, if you will.
Okay. I know I have more questions. If I can just figure out what they are, maybe later in the interview. Okay. The next thing I want to ask you is, where does mind reside? You know, people have an aura around them, electromagnetism thing that's going on. Hmm. Does it reside in the individual mind? Does it reside in that feel of, you know, buzzing of electromagnetism, or where is it?
Well, we don't know. Scientifically, we don't
know.
What
do you think?
But, for me, mind is not a physical concept. So it's, although it's related to the activity of the brain in the body, you cannot localize it because it doesn't have any volume or structure or surface or weight. It's an immaterial construct or concept, and so it cannot be localized within our physical universe. However, it exerts a tremendous influence on what's going on in our physical universe, in our body and brain, and also outside of the brain and the body. But to me, it's an immaterial concept. So it's it cannot be localized or identified within this universe.
Have you ever looked at auras and brainwaves connected?
No, I haven't done this kind of work, but perhaps I know that Gary Schwartz at University of Arizona is very much interested in these questions. He's done some work about this.
Do you think that consciousness, and this time I'm talking about awareness, is in gradients? And what I'm looking to have answered here, if you have any clue, is, you know how when you say an enlightened person is talking to a fundamentalist and they're trying to explain that enlightenment exists, the fundamentalist is going to argue that no, it has to be Jesus or whatever it is, whatever somebody wants to, or Mary or whatever someone calls it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the enlightened person, it's like talking to a telephone pole. Regardless of what the concept is, where it's alternative medicine or what it is, that fundamentalist is not going to understand or even try to understand. But, and they're going to think the enlightenment person is like a know-it-all. So, you know, they have gradients in conscious understanding. That's
absolutely
the only way I know how to describe it. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, totally. I agree with you. And this is the so this is part of the evolutionary process of consciousness, of human consciousness. So there are many different levels or gradients, like you see, regarding the levels of consciousness.
Have you
in
read David Hawkins' work
obvious.
on those gradients? Are you familiar with that?
No.
Is there any physiological reason that there would be gradients in consciousness? In other words, would there be some kind of frequency or pattern or signaling that causes someone to have the perspective that they do?
Mm-hmm. We don't know yet.
What do you think?
Not investigated this question yet in our lab and in other labs. So we don't know yet, but actually we're planning to conduct such a project in my lab. We'd like to compare what's going on in the brain using scanners, partial MRI scanners, and also EEG to measure electrical activity in the brain in people at various level of consciousness, and also related to different spiritual traditions. So that's a project that we will undertake soon if we receive the funding. We're waiting to hear from...
I'd love to have you back. You should read David Hawkins' Power versus Force if you're going to do
that. Yeah, I never read his books, but I will.
Let's see. You mentioned comas. I have a couple of questions about comas. Where does consciousness go when someone's in a coma? What happens to it?
Well, there seems, well, in very deep comas now, there are a few studies out there indicating that it's a little bit similar to what the people experience during near-death experience. So during deep coma, there's a significant amount of injury to the brain, and it seems that there's a sort of dissociation between brain, body, and consciousness. And so the people experiencing these deep comas sometimes have the impression of leaving their physical body. So these kind of comas can last for sometimes a few months or even more. And during this time, it's not unusual for the experiencers to report out-of-body experience. This is very common. And also, sometimes the people will be able to report what's going on in other rooms, for instance, if when they are in at hospital. And very often they are able to provide very accurate information about, you know, details of what's occurring in other rooms and adjacent rooms at the hospital, for instance. And so there seems to be a phenomenon that is quite similar to what happened in the so-called near-death experience. So at that moment, there seems that the connection between the brain and the body versus mind and consciousness is loosening up a lot. And so the person can experience things that normally she won't experience. So that's what's happening at this time. And in terms of brain waves, the brain waves are extremely slow. So we see a lot of delta waves, like I was saying earlier. And it's interesting to know that we see also very slow waves in the brains of people who experience deep meditative or contemplative states. So it's quite interesting because it's been proposed about more than a century ago by William James, the father of the American psychology, that the brain was acting as a sort of reduction valve. And normally, the brain will filter all the information coming from other realms, if you will. And because the brain is focusing more on what's going on in the external and internal environment, but if you can slow down the brain, then the filter becomes less efficient, and then you're allowed to be able to experience other things not related to the functioning of your body or the usual distractions of the mind. You can have access to something more deeper, more interesting from a spiritual perspective.
What do you think is the filter?
And well, the filter is the byproduct of biological evolution. So
I mean, do you think it's
survival and you know, all the basic needs described by Maslow, for instance, and so you need to eat. You know, all these basic needs that humans
the conditioning.
Have. So I think it's very much related. And so if you want to be able to have access volitionally to other realms, dimensions, then you need to alter what's going on. There must be an electrical and chemical shift into what's going on in your brain to have access to these dimensions.
What about magnetism?
Well, some people are saying that you can induce very profound altered states of consciousness using weak electromagnetic currents. So, for instance, in Canada, there's Dr. Michael Persinger at Laurentian University, and he has devised what has been called by journalists the God Helmet. And essentially, he's sending weak electromagnetic currents in the temporal lobe. And the temporal lobe is a region of the brain where sometimes when there's an epileptic seizure, the patient will report a spiritual experience. And so Persinger thought that, I must say that he's very materialist and reductionist, and he believes that, you know, so-called religious or spiritual experiences are simply misfirings of neurons in the temporal lobe region. So about 20-some years ago, he thought that if we send very weak electromagnetic currents in this region of the brain, then it should be possible, theoretically, to induce spiritual experiences. And so he claims that he's been able to generate such experiences in a number of subjects, individuals participating in his experiments during the last two decades, I would say. And so, but these things are very controversial because about 4 years ago, a group of Swedish researchers attempted to replicate his findings And this time, the controlled for the suggestion factor, for the suggestibility. So they used what is called a double-blind randomized placebo approach. And so in one of the groups, they were applying a very weak electromagnetic currents, and in the other group, they were not applying any current at all. And strangely enough, in the control group, they reported more spiritual sensation than in the experimental group, this group receiving the real electromagnetic stimulation. So this question is definitely not settled yet.
How do they account for when brainwaves are totally void, when there's nothing coming out, and people going through the tunnel or seeing the light or whatever it is that they do in their death? How do they say that if it's misfirings, how is their firings going on if everything's dead?
Well, what they say, these guys, I know them very well, they say that it's because we don't have a technology that is good enough to detect subtle residual brain activity. So, you know, usually in these, if you take the case of a cardiac arrest, if you measure electrical activity of the brain with an EEG, usually the brain waves will become totally flat after about 10 seconds after the cardiac arrest. And that's when the people will experience these so-called near-death experiences. But the skeptics, the materialist researchers believe that there's some, you know, residual brain activity that we cannot detect.
I see.
That is why the person would have the impression of floating above the body and so on and so forth. But these objections are not very good because sometimes the people are able to report veridical information about what's going on in the, for instance, the surgery room. There's a good case, very interesting case, the case of a woman named Pam Reynolds, and we discussed this in our book, and this woman was suffering from a major aneurysm at the base of the brain in a region called the brainstem, and this region regulates all the vital functions of the body, so like breathing and heart rate and so on and so forth. And so her life was threatened because the aneurysm, you know, can burst at any time, and it will kill you if it's located within this part of the brain. And she heard about a neurosurgeon called Robert Spedler. Spedler devised a form of surgery called standstill surgery about 30 years ago. And during the standstill surgery, the patient is clinically dead. So the heart is stopped, the blood circulation also is stopped, and automatically the brain shuts down. And it's quite interesting because in her case, although she was clinically dead for a period of about 60 minutes, at a certain point during this state of clinical death, she had the impression of floating above her physical body on the operating in the operating room, and she was able to report dialogues between the neurosurgeons and the nurses and some cardiologists there, and also she was able to draw very precisely some surgical instruments that were used during the surgery. And at a later stage of her experience, she had the sensation of traveling along a tunnel at a very fast pace, and at the other end of the tunnel, she met with deceased relatives and friends, and in the later stage, she encountered what she described as a beautiful being of light. And to her, this beautiful being of light was the intelligent source at the origin of everything in the universe. Mm-hmm. In other words, God. And her life was totally transformed. And so for a hard-nosed materialist, it's very hard to explain how she was able, during this state of clinical death, to have access to the type of information she received. So there's no good explanation for this. And that's why the skeptics will say that perhaps there was still some brain activity, and that's why she was able to, you know, detect these informations. And but it's a very weak argument, really. And but you know, the materialism and reductionism is a sort of religious dogma in science, in current science, and especially in neuroscience. And so, regardless of what you know of the information or the cases you can provide to these persons, these skeptics, they will still keep believing that mind and consciousness are simply byproducts of electrical and chemical activity in the brain. Because if they don't, then their worldview is wrong, and they don't feel very comfortable when they entertain such an idea. So because they are emotionally tied to this this very strong belief, and so that's why they will reject cases like that of Pam Mallows.
Okay, we've got about 20 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and I got a couple. I'm going to tell you some of my questions, and you can pick out which ones that you feel most comfortable answering, okay? I want to talk about free will. Do you think there is free will? And if you think that there is complete free will, I don't mean the decision to turn right or left, because we don't know who's making us turn right or left. You know, we're not driving the car.
Mm-hmm.
How do we account for bad things that happen if we have complete free will? Another thing I want to talk about is, what role do you think minerals and things like niacin play in conscious activity, mind, and thought? I wouldn't mind you talking about the VMA2 gene,
mm-hmm.
neuron replacement, and continuous sense of self. Let's see if there's something else. Signaling. I'm always interested in signaling. Do you think that brain interprets signals from big mind, and that's how we get our information or know something? You know, like, let's say we get a signal, rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat. What happens when that rat-a-tat-tat changes to rat-a-tat-tat-tat? Does that make any sense? Kind of like Morse code?
Yeah, well, it's very hard to, you know, to conclude based on the results of the studies that have been conducted so far, because these studies cannot address this question directly. It's very hard to, because, you know, when you use the tools of neuroscience, like brain imaging, for instance, what you measure essentially is what we call a correlate. So a correlate is a phenomenon that is associated with another phenomenon. So you can ask the person, for instance, to decide to move her finger, and you will see that there's some neural activity in certain parts of the brain, electrical activity. You can measure also other forms of activity, like the release, for instance, of a chemical messenger, neurotransmitter.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't tell you whether these correlates have any causal role to play in the function, the cognitive function, or the emotion you're investigating. So in other words, you can see signals in the brain preceding by 300 milliseconds, for instance, the impression of deciding a flexion of your right finger, or you know, right index, for instance. And but it's very tricky, this question of, for instance, free will, because I don't believe in absolute free will, because you have, you know, biological constraints, so you have to deal with these things. So, but there's we've done a series of studies in our lab during the last 10 years showing that human beings have the capacity to definitely influence what's going on in the brain at whether an electrical or chemical level. I'll give you an example. We have worked with, for instance, actors, professional actors in the Montreal region, and we asked them to either self-generate a very intense state of either sadness or joy, and we were measuring the activity of a chemical messenger named serotonin. Serotonin is involved in all sorts of functions, including sleep, and it's also involved in spirituality, but it's a key chemical messenger in terms of mood regulation. And so it took about 10 minutes to the actors to self-generate very intense emotional state. And it was very interesting to know that after about 10 minutes, the direction that was taking the release of serotonin in the brain was totally opposite. So, and when they were entertaining very sad memories and thoughts, the level of serotonin in the brain was decreasing significantly. And when they were contemplating happy memories and happy states, there was a release and an increase in terms of the release of serotonin in the regions of the brain that are associated with emotions. And so this is one experiment that we conducted. We have also conducted other experiments using brain imaging. For instance, we decided to use to induce a transient state of sexual arousal in university students, all males. They were so in a normal condition, they were seeing erotic film clips, and so we saw very robust activation of what we call the limbic system. This is a synonym for the emotional portion of the brain, and so this was expected. In another experimental condition, we asked them to become detached observers of the erotic film excerpts and also of the reactions that they were perceiving in their own bodies, physiological reactions and also subjective reactions, the feelings. And simply by doing this, these people were able to suppress to a great extent the activity of the so-called limbic system, all the emotional, the key emotional regions involved in the processing of the erotic film excerpt. So, and these people were not experts at meditation at all. So they never meditated that, actually. And we did other experiments, even in children, and we taught them how to self-regulate sadness, for instance, using film excerpts. And if you take these results together, then it's clear that human beings have a certain amount of responsibility in terms of what's going on in their own brain and body, and they also they have a certain power. I wouldn't say that they have absolute total power, because you always have to take into account biological determinism, for instance, and the kind of genes that you have, and in which milieu have you been raised, for instance, and how were your parents with you, and you know, all these factors play an important role. But still, we have a certain amount of autodetermination or auto-regulation that is possible within us. And so I wouldn't say that we have absolute free will, but will can be a very strong factor in terms of what's happening in your brain and also in your body. And this has been well demonstrated also by a field that is called psychoneuroimmunology. So this discipline studies the interaction between the nervous system and the immune and endocrine systems also with respect to psychological processes.
I wish we had another hour to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of my questions. You're going to have to come back. okay, another thing I wanted to ask you about, and I ask a lot of the scientists that come on my show this question. I interview a lot of, for lack of a better word, I'm going to use spiritually evolved, awake people, that's what I call them. I don't know what else to call them. Every single person that I've ever interviewed that's very evolved consciously has a high-pitched noise in their ears. And I was talking to Irvin Laszlo. Do you know Irvin?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And I mentioned this to him, and he knew, you know, he's got a music background.
Mm-hmm.
He knew exactly what I was talking about, and he went, yes, Eva, it's B-flat, which, interestingly, you know, is the sound that comes from the black holes and the sound of silence, from what I understand, the frequency of silence. Why would you think that? Don't you think it's interesting that all of these awake people have this same high-pitched sound in their ears? They all thought it was tinnitus, and I don't know what it is. I just know that we all have it.
Yeah, well,
what could that be? And they manifest their intention.
I have this,
all seem
too,
to
but
manifest.
I didn't know that this was the case for you know, people like you and me, and I never thought about this, so I'm just learning it.
Another thing Norm Shealy made me think about was, you know, when people have a lot of, well, first of all, we're electromagnetic beings and we have frequency. You know, frequency drives everything. So we wondered if maybe somehow these people that are awake have obviously probably a higher frequency, but it also burns up their magnesium, because a lot of people who have tinnitus or ringing in their ears have, you know, deficient magnesium levels. Could there be some connection there?
Well, this could be studied scientifically. But
do you hear that sound?
Yes,
I knew
what you're talking about.
I knew you would know what I was talking about.
Absolutely.
Did it come along at the time in your life when you had a shift?
Yes, yes, that's what I've experienced.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, what the heck is it?
Well, we should study it.
You know, and if you think about it, it's the same sound that you hear if you go out in the middle of the woods where it's silent. That high-pitched screaming of the silence of the woods, it's that sound. And people who have it always seem to have a greater capability to manifest mass quicker. Does that make any sense to you? Do you have any comment on that?
Well, perhaps it's the sign of a contact, transient contact with a higher dimension.
What happened to you?
You know, when you talk about more evolved beings, if you believe in, for instance, reincarnation, if you believe that souls or, you know, higher selves can have multiple lives, then it would make sense that these entities would inhabit successively more refined or complex bodies with, you know, brains that will allow them to be connected with a higher dimension, you know, on a more constant basis.
Makes sense.
That's just an hypothesis, but
well, it's logical. Tell me, we got about 8 minutes.
Okay.
What happened to you? How did you come to understand enlightenment? Not very many doctors do.
Well, because a lot of I started to have very deep spiritual experiences when I was about 8 years old. I'm now 46, and so I'm not your usual orthodox scientist. I'm a mystical type of scientist, if you will, and my worldview is based on mostly on these experiences. And I've had a near-death experience, for instance, when I was in my early 20s. And
what happened? What did you
I've
see?
Had, well, I was I've been very, very sick for several years. I had multiple viruses in my body, and I suffered from an inflammation of the membranes protecting the brain, and all sorts of things happened to me. And so it didn't look very good from a physical standpoint. And during that period, I've had a near-death experience. But before that, I've had a series of spiritual experiences, including so-called cosmic states of consciousness. So this is a state of consciousness in which you you realize that you are one with everything that exists in the universe and in other worlds. And so that's why we talk about cosmic consciousness then. And once you have had this experience, then of course your life will be altered forever after that. And
did your peers
I've had several
deal
of these
with
experiences,
you?
So that's you know, that's the main reason why I have a different worldview than most of my neuroscientist colleagues.
How do they accept you?
Well, because I'm doing, I've done a lot of studies, more formal studies, you know, related to the field of emotional self-regulation in the brain, and they accept me rather well, and so perhaps they are not always, you know, in agreement with what I'm saying and my views about mind, brain, consciousness, but still, I would say that they respect me to a great degree, and I think that there's more open-mindedness now that than let's say 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and so there seems to be an evolution at this level and everywhere around the world, and And also, it becomes more obvious that the materialist view is totally erroneous. And for me, it's only a matter of time. I think that in 10 or 20 years from now, it will be totally passed, passé, and we'll have a new worldview as a human, as a species. And,
it's coming, right?
So I'm firmly convinced about that. And,
one
so
more
it's
question.
Not now a problem like perhaps 20 years ago. It's there's more understanding and open-mindedness, like I was saying, and so we're getting there slowly. But we have to, because we have to realize who we are really in terms of human beings, and we have to be conscious of where we live, and the planet Earth is living, and also of the other kingdoms, and if we still want to have a future as a species from a physical perspective, then we have to be aware rapidly of all these issues. So we have to evolve, to grow rapidly, and I think that's exactly what's happening right now.
One more question. We got about 5 minutes. You mentioned in your book about some psychological test that can measure self-transcendence. I've never heard of that. What is it?
It's the mysticism scale. So it's a scale that has been devised by Ralph Hood at the University of Tennessee in 1975, and it's been used in various universities around the world, various labs, to measure various components related to the to mystical or very intense spiritual experiences, and the scale is valid for various spiritual traditions. So it's not related strictly to the Christian tradition. It's also valid for Eastern spirituality. And
it's one of the
best scales out there, to measure these aspects. So in this scale, you will. You can have access, or you have items related to the perceptual processes associated with these experiences. You also have the emotional component. There's also a transcendental aspect in this scale, and and so on and so forth. So these experiences are very multidimensional, and they cover the various aspects of human functioning. And this scale targets very well all those various dimensions.
Okay. If somebody has something like this going on in their life, and they go to see their mental health professional, as well as I do, they're going to diagnose them with as being a psychotic or delusional or schizophrenic.
Yes.
Can they tell their person to test them for this so that they can understand that it's something real for them?
Yes.
Will that help
the
professional know what they're talking about?
Well, yeah. You have to be very careful when you because if you start because that happened to me 20-some years ago when I was very sick, and I reported to medical doctors some of my experiences, and so they gave me antipsychotic drugs because they thought that I was schizophrenic. And so you have to be very careful, and you have to trust also the people around you, so either your parents or your wife or the people that are very near you. You have to try to explain to them that you're not suffering from psychosis, but sometimes it's not very obvious. It's hard, and of course, no antipsychotic treatment will help you regarding these experiences, because these experiences are very important throughout your own evolutionary process. So you have to go through this this process, and so yes, we have to be careful, because not too many psychiatrists are either aware of these experiences, or because they are mostly materialists and reductionists, they will believe that there's an alteration in terms of what's going on chemically in your brain, and this alteration would cause cause these experiences. But we have to be careful, and it's very tricky, because in certain psychotic patients, sometimes they have religious delusions also. So it's a very tricky question.
Okay, we've run out of time here. So it's Dr. Mario Beauregard, B-E-A-U, R-E-G-A-R-D, right? And your book is The Spiritual Brain.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you for what you do. Somebody needs to do it. I'm so glad that you're doing it. Thank you.
Well, thanks to you.
And I hope you'll come back and fill me in on research as you're doing at your lab. Time went by too fast.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Dr. Beauregard, and good night.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.